Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Today's show will be a rerun due to the illness of our editor. We'll be back with new programming on Monday.
This is Ed Barreno with an important health update. Flu activity is increasing across the nation, including here in San Diego County. To date, 357 lab-confirmed influenza cases have been reported in San Diego. This is over 1.5 times higher than the 216 cases reported at the same time last year. The number of lab-confirmed cases reported this past week is 154, double the number reported the same week last year. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a health alert last week reporting severe respiratory illness in several states over the past 2 months, especially among young and middle-aged adults. Many of them were found to be infected with pandemic H1N1, with cases resulting in hospitalization, intensive care, or in some instances, death, though none of the deaths were in San Diego County thus far this season. The predominant virus circulating nationally so far is pandemic H1N1. Locally, about 96% of the reported cases have been influenza A. When the specific subtype was tested, 8 out of 10 San Diego patients were found to be pandemic H1N1. The good news is that the current flu vaccines offer protection against pandemic H1N1 as well as influenza A, H3N2, and influenza B strains. The CDC has determined that the vaccines are well matched for the currently circulating viruses. The CDC recommends that everyone 6 months or older get a flu vaccine every year. The vaccine is safe, effective, and available at many locations in the county. County Public Health Director Wilma Wooten added, "The flu season typically lasts through April. If you haven't gotten your shot this season, you could get vaccinated now to protect yourself and your family." The vaccine is available throughout San Diego County at doctor's offices and retail pharmacies. County public health centers have flu vaccine available for children and adults with no medical insurance. For a list of locations, visit www.sdiz.org or call 211.
This is Janice Mork, reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ. Alcohol police are asking the public to help locate a white Ford truck that struck a pedestrian near Main Street and Hamishaw at 10.09 p.m. on January 6th. After the driver fled the scene, the pedestrian was hit by another vehicle and died at the scene. It is believed that the initial vehicle involved in the collision that left the scene was a 2008-2010 Ford F-350 to F-550 utility work truck. This truck is white in color with the Deco logo on the front door and is equipped with a personal bucket lift crane and a utility bed. The truck should have damage to the right headlight area as a result of the collision. The investigation found that the vehicle was crossing the road mid-block and was struck by a northbound vehicle that fled the scene. A second vehicle then struck the pedestrian lying in the roadway. The occupants of the second vehicle remained on scene and have been cooperative with the investigation, according to police. The driver and passenger of the second vehicle were not injured. At this time, there is no evidence to indicate that speed or alcohol were factors in this collision. However, this investigation is ongoing, said Lieutenant R. Solard. Information about the victim is not being released pending family notification. Anyone with information regarding this collision or the vehicle involved is encouraged to contact the El Cajon Police Department Traffic Division at 619-441-1632.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show, guest hosting the Tribal Beat today for Leon Thompson, who's continuing his recovery from open-heart surgery, and we certainly wish him well. Our guest today is Stephen Newcomb, a Shawnee and Lenape, and the author of Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery. Professor Mary Wood at the University of Oregon School of Law has said that Mr. Newcomb's use of cognitive theory, meaning theory of the human mind, in the writing of Pagans in the Promised Land creates a new paradigm for the study of U.S. federal Indian law. Mr. Newcomb has been studying U.S. federal Indian law and international law since the early 1980s, when he majored in rhetoric and communication at the University of Oregon. He's published law review articles for several prominent universities in the U.S. and Australia, and he's been working over 20 years in the international arena and the United Nations regarding the rights of indigenous nations and peoples. In 1992, he and his friend and mentor, Virgil Kills Strait, who's a traditional Oglala Lakota headman of the Oglala Lakota Nation, founded the Indigenous Law Institute. Together, they began a global campaign calling upon Pope John Paul II back then to revoke the Inter Cetera papal document issued by Pope Alexander VI back in 1493, 1 year after Columbus. Since the year 2000, Mr. Newcomb has been a columnist with Indian Country, and currently he's working for the Sequan Band of the Kumeyaay Nation in the Sequan Cultural Department and the archives at Kumeyaay Community College. He lives in Kumeyaay Territory in what is now commonly called East San Diego County. Steve, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you start by telling us how you ended up writing about American Indian and Indigenous peoples' issues?
As a teenager, I had the opportunity to stay periodically with a Chumash medicine man named Semu Huaute, and I learned from him and many other traditional elders and medicine people about the wisdom and teachings of our ancestors. And from there, I went into the University of Oregon thinking that I would become an attorney someday and help our nations and peoples through the use of law. And through those investigations, I actually found out that the U.S. federal Indian law system is premised upon Christian dogma, Christian teachings out of the Old Testament, and the use of those against our nations and peoples. And I became very disenchanted with the entire idea of the federal Indian law system. And so I followed up on that with over a decade of my own personal research into the origins of international law and federal Indian law, and found out that the U.S. federal Indian law system is based upon a primary doctrine, which is the idea that the first Christian people to discover, quote-unquote, discover the lands of heathens and infidels have the right, so they claim, to take over all the lands and resources of the original nations and peoples of those geographical regions.
Fascinating. And so that traces back to this papal document?
Right. The papal document from 1493 called the Inter Cetera Papal Bull, issued by Pope Alexander VI, it says that it is cherished of the heart of the divine majesty, meaning of God, that the barbarous nations be subjugated and brought to the faith itself. And it talks about the propagation of the Christian empire. And there's a sentence in the document that says, "We trust in him," with a capital H on him, "from whom empires and dominations and all good things proceed." And so what you see are patterns of domination and dehumanization throughout that document. And that particular document is connected to many others.
My goodness. What is the main theme of your book, Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Discovery?
Well, the theme of the book goes back to the same idea of Christian discovery that I just mentioned, and the claim of a Christian dominion. And it traces back to a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1823 called Johnson versus McIntosh.
And what was that about?
Well, it had to do with a property dispute between non-Indian claimants to the same property, or so we were told. It turns out that the two properties that were supposedly in conflict, or that there was a conflict over the same piece of property, the two properties were not within 50 miles of each other. So it was a made-up case. It had really no basis in fact, but they pretended to have a dispute. The issue was whether the land companies that purchased the lands directly from the Indian nations, meaning the Illinois and Piankashaw Indian nations, or a separate person named William McIntosh who purchased that land from the U.S. government, which of those two claimants had the superior title within the court system of the United States.
And what did the court rule?
Well, the court ruled that William McIntosh, the individual, had a superior title, but Chief Justice John Marshall, who wrote that decision, used it as an opportunity to go back to these early doctrines. And he said that discovery gave title to the governments by whose subjects or by whose authority the discovery was made against all other European governments. But when he went to explain that particular principle, he used the charters of England and many other charters of other countries, but primarily the charters of England said that, for example, the John Cabot Charter said that the Christian people had the right to go to non-Christian lands and to claim a superior title to those lands.
Yeah, it just seems shocking by today's standards. So what else is brought out in your book? Is there anything else that you'd like our listeners to know specifically about your book before we move on to talking about these Vatican documents and their relevance today?
Well, I think that the book lays out very clearly the language system that is used by the United States to this day based upon those ancient documents and the patterns found within them. And that we'll get into the way in which the U.S. government used those doctrines and documents in the 1950s.
So this was used, I presume, to justify all of the conquest of the Indian lands and the taking of the lands of the Native American people.
I don't call it the conquest, even though they call it that, because that sounds like that's a fait accompli, something that's over and done with. I call it domination.
Right.
So they've claimed a right of domination over the lands and resources of the original nations and peoples of this region of the world.
Yeah, who were forced onto reservations and everything else.
All of that, yes, and on the basis of these doctrines. So it's imperative for people to understand that these patterns of domination are characteristic of the entire societal system of the United States and many other countries throughout the world.
So we need to understand the past before we can address the future and what should be done, perhaps. What is the significance of the Vatican documents that you and Virgil Kilstraight began challenging back in the early 1990s, and how are these 500-year-old documents relevant in today's world, other than as a historical teaching moment?
Well, as I already stated, you have these patterns of domination. There's a specific language system that's used for that. And that language system is very well illustrated in those documents. And the very first document that I'll point to, it's called the Dum Diversus from 1452. And it instructs King Alfonso of Portugal to go to the western coast of Africa and to invade, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ, to reduce their persons to perpetual slavery and to take away all their possessions and property. All of those words are key terms of vocabulary for purposes of domination and dehumanization. That particular document issued by Pope Nicholas V to King Alfonso of Portugal was not only a carrier of this pattern of domination and dehumanization that I'm mentioning, but it is indicative of the types of patterns that have been used and continue to be used to this day against original nations and peoples throughout the world.
Is there a way that you can see to change that pattern? When you've studied the laws, how can this tide be reversed, and is there a way to right some of these wrongs?
Well, it has to do with identifying it. We have to be able to name it. And what's interesting is that even the term indigenous, as in indigenous peoples, the international working definition of that means dominated peoples or peoples under dominance or domination. The thing is that it's usually the approach to say that peoples under that dominance have certain rights, but under rights under that domination. What we're saying is that we have the right to free ourselves from the domination. That's the fundamental
right. Much like abolition of slavery.
That's exactly correct. But we also have to look at not just the way in which it is characteristic of the predicament for original nations and peoples, but for all human beings and all beings on the planet. Mm-hmm. In other words, these are patterns that are afflicting everyone and everything throughout the world. How is it that we can't go to any university in the world and find a Department of Domination Studies?
Fascinating. You started this global campaign calling on back then Pope John Paul II to revoke the Inter Cetera that was issued by Pope Alexander. Have you reached out to the new Pope, Pope Francis, who seems to have a soft spot in his heart for taking up the causes of poor and oppressed peoples.
There are Catholic groups that have just recently joined our campaign. And in 2010, the theme for the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues was the doctrine of Christian discovery.
Interesting. Although that was before Pope Francis.
Right. And so people from all over the world, from every region of the world, condemned the doctrine. And I was there for that occasion, and I was part of the drafting of the formal report that went to the UN regarding this issue. And what has happened since then is that the Episcopal Church has condemned it. The Quakers have condemned it, many chapters of the Quakers. The Methodists have condemned it. The Unitarians have condemned it. The World Council of Churches have condemned it. So we see a global mobilization against the patterns of domination and dehumanization.
What would it mean if Pope Francis, who is the first pope, incidentally, out of the New World, what would it mean if he were to renounce that doctrine, that document?
Well, the main thing that it would mean is that it would be finally gaining the type of visibility globally that it would need in order to be reversed or undone. And this is a very tall order, because if the language systems that are being used are carriers of the patterns of domination and dehumanization that I'm talking about, then how it seems to me that you have to change those language systems in some fundamental manner in order to truly deal with this issue. And that's a very tall order. But his message, or his repudiation of this pattern of domination, would be very instrumental in that effort.
If the doctrine of domination were repudiated, what would be the ultimate outcome, I'm curious, that you would like to see? It seems to me this is a little bit like Israel and Palestine, where you have two groups that have now been there for thousands of years, both claiming a right to the same, you know, piece of land. In this case, the United States alone, we have a very vast country. And we have the Native Americans who have been here since, you know, time immemorial. We also have the many immigrants from many other places who came here and have,
and their descendants have
been here, some of them hundreds of years now. How do you resolve these two sort of competing issues?
Well, we're really talking about what is the right way to live.
Mm-hmm.
What is the right way to live with one another and with other life forms? We've been here for thousands and thousands and thousands of years within the Great Turtle Island and throughout this continent, throughout this hemisphere. And if you look at that pattern of time, our ancestors did not create radioactive, toxic landfills. That we did not destroy the very basis of the fabric of life, which is happening now. What we're talking about is the need to have a completely different pattern of organization for human beings and the relationship of human beings to other life forms, so that it becomes sustained in perpetuity, not destroyed.
This is much like the Idle No More movement in Canada, the Native rights movement.
This has to do with a fundamental questioning of the very basis of the idea of civilization. There's a Webster's Unabridged Dictionary definition of civilization that is very critical to this conversation, and that definition is this: the forcing of a particular cultural pattern on a population to whom it is foreign. You cannot force a cultural pattern on other nations and peoples and impose that on them in a system of domination without creating tremendous havoc and destruction. You cannot impose destructive patterns on other life forms or create toxins in waterways and do all these destructive things and expect positive outcomes.
Yeah, so it's also partly about respect for Mother Earth, as the Idle No More movement has talked about. What is your view of the rights of indigenous nations and peoples today?
Well, I talk about it in terms of the rights of original nations and peoples, so that I avoid the use, just the unquestioning use of that term indigenous. If it does mean under dominance, then certainly we don't want to acknowledge that as having any legitimacy. And so,
I'll rephrase and say, what is your view of the rights of the original nations and peoples? That's a very good linguistic point of view. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, the view is that we have a right to be free from domination. And all of these systems that have been institutionalized replicate those patterns. So we first of all have to bring them up to the surface, make sure that people are consciously aware of them, and then we have a clear choice to no longer repeat those same patterns.
Yeah.
So it's a very daunting task that faces us, especially given the ways in which the United States and many other countries of the world are moving toward totalitarian systems in league with corporate interests that are really interested in just completely exploiting the planet right down to the last bit of resources.
Right, and really taking away the rights of many people, even beyond the original peoples.
Well, that's right, because the National Defense Authorization Act, which the government has, the United States government has passed, allows the indefinite detention of people that they deem to be politically dissident
yeah,
or what
even
have
citizens.
You. Right, and without trial, without attorney, without due process of law. There are very ominous things on the horizon that are all instances or examples of these patterns of domination and dehumanization.
Certainly some of the things we've seen with mining operations and large energy projects around the world and even in some cases
those are all the patterns of colonization. Patterns of domination are found in the term colonization, but also there's a term colo, which means to filter out impurities in the process of mining. And when you take the colon, the digestive tract, it's the body politic's digestive tract and the consuming. It's a predatory body politic that consumes and devours and uses energy for its patterns of consumption to sustain itself over time.
Fascinating. Steve, what is the most important message that you would like our listeners to take away from all of this? And is there anything that people listening out there can do to get involved?
You can look at our Indigenous Law Institute website. It's called Indigenous Law Institute. If you type that, those words into the internet system and hit enter, it'll go right to our website. And you can read my book, Pagans in the Promised Land. Email me, I suppose, if you want to get involved in our efforts to revoke the papal bull. But more importantly, look at the ways in which you start to see the patterns of domination. For example, the violence against women throughout the planet, that's an example of domination and dehumanization.
Yes.
There are so many ways in which domination and dehumanization are normalized and not recognized as being those patterns. In other words, they're viewed as something else, something more euphemistic. And so we need to become fully conscious of those patterns and make the determination that we're going to change them. And we need the alternatives, and that's where our traditional teachings and wisdoms, examples of teachings and wisdom come into play.
Yes, I have great respect for those teachings and wisdoms of the original people, the native people. Steve, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the Tribal Beat segment of the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, which is the Network for Social Justice, and I think this is really the ultimate social justice issue.
Thank you.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week's Destination East County includes a mix of nature activities, indoor films and performances, along with some art, music, and kids' activities. Enjoy a star party under the night skies at Mission Trails Regional Park on Saturday, January 11th between 5 and 8 p.m. Resident stargazer George Varga and his telescopes can access multiple night sky locations, including the Pleiades, or Seven Sisters, the Andromeda Galaxy, and the Orion Nebula. Meet at the far end of the Kumeyaay Campground Day Use parking lot on 2 Father Junipero Serra Trail in Santee. At the Visitor's Center on 1 Junipero Serra Trail, the first art show of the year will be on display through January 31st in the gallery wing of the Visitor's Center, with 7 artists, mixed media works, including watercolor and Asian brush painting. A winter festival will be held over the weekend at Poway Community Park on Friday, January 10th from 5 to 9 p.m. and Saturday, January 11th from 4 to 9 p.m. There will be a snow hill, ice skating, s'mores, and vendors. Admission is free. Poway Community Park is located on Civic Center Drive in Poway. A family fun fest is being celebrated at the Salvation Army Croc Center on University Avenue in San Diego, just outside of La Mesa, on Saturday, January 11th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., where visitors can enjoy an instrument petting zoo, that's right, sports challenges, a painting station, giveaways, inflatables, costume dress-ups, and more. Admission is free. At Bistro 60 Restaurant on El Cajon Boulevard in the College area, enjoy the music of guitarist and singer-songwriter Suzanne Shea on Tuesday evenings from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. and live acoustic music by Nathan Weldon on Thursday evenings, whose music is characterized as a fresh fusion of James Taylor and Jim Croce. Local cinematic history comes to life again when the La Mesa Historical Society and Theater Organ Society of San Diego partner for an evening of local living cinematic history with organ-accompanied silent films. Motion Pictures' long-forgotten La Mesa roots will be presented in historic style as noted San Diego pipe organist Russ Peck plays his new scores to two silent films, one made right here locally in 1911. This second annual silent movie night takes place on Saturday, January 11th at 7 p.m. at the Trinity Presbyterian Church on Kenwood Drive in Spring Valley. This is a family-friendly event that will begin with a short presentation by local historian Jim Newland on the pioneering American film manufacturing company's one-year tenure in La Mesa from 1911 to 1912. This presentation will be followed by Peck's accompaniment to a locally made 1911 Flying A 12-minute one-reeler entitled The Ranchman's Nerve, and the classic 1929 swashbuckler The Iron Mask, starring silent film superstar Douglas Fairbanks. The History Alive lecture series, sponsored by the Lemon Grove Historical Society, continues on January 9th at 7 p.m. in the H. Lee House Cultural Center in Lemon Grove, when writer-teacher Estelle Gibson Lauer discusses recent immigrants to San Diego County, history right now. Lauer's work with immigrants from many lands has revealed ancient animosities leading to culture shock on both sides of the equation, legal misunderstandings, and often hilarious misconceptions as newcomers adjust to life in an open society. The lecture is free and suitable for ages 13 and over, and refreshments follow the presentation. History Alive is made possible in part by a grant from the Mary England Endowment for Education. Videotaping of History Alive lectures is made possible by a community enhancement grant from the San Diego County Board of Supervisors on the recommendation of Supervisor Diane Jacob, District 2. There will be an introductory class of geocaching at Sycamore Canyon Gooden Ranch Preserve in Poway. The leader will teach this new kind of treasure hunting in which participants use a handheld GPS device to locate hidden objects, such as a hidden container with a logbook and small trinkets inside. The class takes place on Saturday, January 11th, from 9 to 11 a.m. at the Sycamore Canyon Gooden Ranch Preserve in Poway. This program is aimed at guests who have never played the sport and would like to learn about it. A slideshow and discussion in the visitor center will be followed by geocaching in the park. It is recommended that guests bring their own GPS units, as the number available are limited, but one can still enjoy it without one. Two new geocaches will be placed for this event. This week we have some exciting ongoing events for our listeners to enjoy over and over again if necessary. On Wednesday, January 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Lemon Grove Library, the Lemon Grove Historical Society presents the first film in a series entitled John Adams, the HBO series on the life and times of America's second president and first vice president, from his life as a farmer lawyer through the tumult of the American Revolution, to his defeat and retirement from the White House, to his final days. Admission is free and is for those 18 and older. The film series continues each Wednesday at the Lemon Grove Library through February 19th, always starting at 6:30 p.m. Ballet Folklorico and Aztlan will be presenting free Sunday Zapateados on several dates throughout 2014 at the Muévete Dance Studio in Lemon Grove. These presentations also provide information about the sampler or cuadro of dances performed, usually from one of the 32 regions of Mexico in each performance. The performances last about a half hour. The Zapateado this Sunday at 2 p.m. on January 12th is from the region of Tamaulipas. The other Sunday Zapateado dates, all at 2 p.m., are on February 9th, a full main show for Cinco de Mayo held on May 4th, June 8th, and August 3rd. In addition, an upcoming event at the studio will take place on Saturday, February 1st at 4 p.m., when there will be a children's dance production with a few adults called Slorillo. Lindo Lake County Park in Lakeside offers a scenic nature hike every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. with a ranger around the lake, where hikers can explore native plants and the animals inhabiting the East Basin and discover the rich history behind this natural lake. Hikers are invited to meet in front of Pavilion 1 on the southeast side of the park and are encouraged to bring sunscreen, water, and comfortable shoes. That's all for this week. All of these events and more are on our calendar and in our Festival and Events section at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
The Destination East County segment on the East County Magazine radio show is made possible by a community enhancement grant from the County of San Diego.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ, bringing you a story today that's made in the shade. Takeda California, a division of Japan's largest pharmaceutical company, plans to plant 2,000 trees along a one-mile stretch of the San Diego River in Santee's new Walker Preserve on January 20th. That's 20 times more trees than the drug discovery company used in paper during the entire last year. The trees will be planted by Takeda employees, family members, and friends. The effort will benefit the San Diego River Park Foundation and Walker Preserve by introducing native coast live oak, scrub oak, Engelmann oak, laurel sumac, cottonwood sycamore, lemonade berry, and elderberry to lands previously used for mining operations. The Walker Preserve was acquired back in 2012 by the City of Santee to preserve wildlife in the area and fill a crucial gap in the San Diego River Trail. The goal ultimately is to create a 1.3-mile-long multi-use trail along the river with interpretive signs and other amenities for the public. Keith Wilson, President and Chief Scientific Officer at Takeda, said, "We want to offset our carbon footprint, and our goal this year is to plant 20 times more trees than we use in paper. This should help to make a positive environmental difference in San Diego. The company will plant a mix of trees native to California and that are naturally found along the river. In addition to providing shade and removing carbon dioxide from the air, these trees will enhance the water quality, habitats, and nesting areas for birds and other wildlife. They will also enhance the visitor experience when the stretch of the River Park system is completed and open to the public. Takeda, California is no stranger to volunteerism in the San Diego community. Their involvement with San Diego River Park Foundation is part of the company's ongoing dedication and commitment to society through corporate social responsibility activities. In 2011, Takeda, California helped San Diego River Park Foundation permanently conserve 156 acres in Putz Creek Preserve through a donation and an employee matching gift. Each year, the company chooses projects locally to support. Richard Dew is program manager at the San Diego River Park Foundation. He said that San Diego County is a hugely significant hotspot of biodiversity, having more unique species of plants and animals than any other county in the mainland United States. He voiced appreciation for Takeda's efforts to restore the region's natural beauty, and then he added, "We hope more businesses will join us in helping to care for our local environment and helping to revitalize the San Diego River."
This is Ed Barrena reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ. The Miss California USA competition was held January 4th at the Terrence Theater in Long Beach, and one of San Diego's own won the competition. Cassandra Kuntz, a resident of Crest and a student at San Diego State University, has been crowned winner of the 2014 Miss California USA competition. Miss Kuntz is also a graduate of Grossmont College in El Cajon. She is working to complete a double major at SDSU in International Security and Conflict Resolution and Television Film Media. She represented Beverly Hills at the time of her pageant entry and will next compete at the Miss USA pageant representing California.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Mike Sirota, author of Freedom's Hand, with Atorus Press, as well as over 20 novels, including ghost stories, horror fiction, adventure fantasy, and swords and sorcery. My guest is also an award-winning feature writer and editor. He's been workshop facilitator, university instructor, and writing coach. Welcome, Mike. It's great to see you again and have you here in the studio.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's begin with your latest novel, Freedom's Hand, which is about a concentration camp established not in Poland, but in the desert of the American Southwest. Tell us about that. It's a fascinating premise. And what prompted you to write about it?
Well, I grew up in New York City back in the 50s, and there were a lot of people there who were kind of different. They were quiet. They were surly. They just didn't talk too much. And once in a while, we noticed they had numbers on their arms. Well, what could that possibly be? No one spoke about the Holocaust then. These were all survivors, and no one talked about it too much. And I grew up in the dark. And when I finally, years later, found out what it was all about, it was powerful. I not only learned who and what these people were, but I also found out that our own family had victims that perished in the Holocaust. And I just felt I had to do something about that. So I waited a while. It took a while to do Freedom's Hand, but that was sort of the foundation for it. And the idea that it might happen again is not inconceivable. So that was the basis for it.
Why the American Southwest? How did that come about?
Well, I live here.
Right.
I live in California. I don't want to give away too much about where the camp is, but I'm pretty familiar with the desert. And I thought, of all places, it's so bleak and barren. Mm-hmm. That if someone did do something as horrific as that, they would put it in a place that would be practically inaccessible to most people. Even for themselves, it's quite difficult getting to where I've located this camp.
Is it just a fictional idea, or do you also believe that this is something that could actually happen in the United States?
Well, I don't know about the United States. I mean, it happened during World War II with Japanese internment and all. But even to this day, these things are happening. They're happening all over the world. They're happening. Look at North Korea.
Right.
North Korea has detention camps, labor camps right now that people are worked to death in. So it's not impossible that this could happen and that people – like my fictional commander who runs the camp and who devised this whole thing, There are people like that now, like the guy in North Korea.
Sure.
And that's the scariest thing, is that there are still people out there, people that hate so much. On my blog, I remember writing about what I call "Hate Never Dies." It's a little parody on Andrew Lloyd Webber's "Love Never Dies." I call it "Hate Never Dies" because that's the truth. There seems to be people like this always, unfortunately.
Right, and it can happen in a beautiful place like the American Southwest.
Why not?
Well, I know that in addition to the accomplishments that I mentioned earlier, you spent 14 years as an award-winning feature writer and editor for a Southern California news magazine. What magazine is that, or was that, and how did that kind of work compared to writing fiction?
Yes, past tense. It was the San Diego Jewish Times.
Oh.
I was their editor and feature writer, and they had a good run. They operated between 25 and 30 years, I believe, before they finally closed down, kind of victimized by the fact that everything is online these days and all that. The only way they could publish, of course, was to sell advertising, and the original owners did a great, great job of that. Ultimately, they retired, and the people taking it over couldn't keep up that pace. They lost the advertising revenue, and out they went. But it was a nice run for me. It was a good foundation. You don't get rich writing novels.
No.
So at least I had a paycheck every week and had some health coverage and all of that, and the freedom to do a lot of what I did, which was write and teach and all of that. But the writing was different. You know, we have X column inches, and we have to write 342 words. Maybe you can give one, you know, or take one or two, but that's what we had to do, 342 words. And for a novelist who's written novels of up to a quarter of a million words, that's kind of limiting.
Right.
But I got used to it. I got used to doing that. And I think it actually helped my writing also, being more succinct in my, you know, fiction writing.
Right. It's a discipline.
Right, right. So it was a good run. I got to meet a lot of interesting people. I think the highlight of my career there was on my 50th birthday, which was a long time ago. I got to interview Elie Wiesel, who was the author of Night, and of course, Holocaust survivor, Nobel Prize winner, one of the first people who actually started bringing the Holocaust to light and had the guts to write about it, about his experiences. So I think that was one of the highlights of working there.
It sounds like you've really combined your interest in history with fantasy, and is that correct, and horror and that?
Right, right. Well, I have a great deal of interest in Native Americans, and in three of my four horror novels, if you want to call them that, ghost stories, they are Native American themed, getting into the mythology of the particular tribes, all of which, for some reason, I picked ones in Northern California. And actually, my next novel, which I know you were going to ask me anyway, is a historical novel. It's kind of the work of over maybe 30 years, I think, on and off that I have worked on this novel. And I finally got it to where I wanted it to be, I believe, and I think I'm going to put it out next year. And it is a historical novel on a particular tribe up in Northern California that not many people know about, but they had an amazing story, an amazing history, both with their war with the United States government. And I chose as the main character a woman in the tribe, a real woman, who married a white man. And together they went through all the conflict between these tribes and ultimately served as interpreters during the war.
Wow.
And just recently I made contact with her great-great-granddaughter, who is still around.
Really?
And she's pretty much excited about, you know, having me do this and all. It is a novel, but it's, I'd say, 90% true. I put in a few extra characters here and there. You know, we take a little bit of liberty when we write novels, but the story, the bulk of the story, or the heart of the story, is true.
Can you tell us the name of the novel? Or not yet?
Well, I can. It's called Stone Woman.
Okay.
The stone being the lava beds in Northern California, which is where the war took place. I visited the lava beds years ago. It's one of the most forbidding and really creepy, mm-hmm. you know, places you could imagine. And the gist of the war itself was that 50 Braves fought off 1,000 U.S. soldiers for up to 6 months.
Really?
During the war, and lost hardly any of their people in their tribe. Mm-hmm. It was just an amazing, amazing story of courage and everything. And, of course, the typical, the white people got there, took the land, took this, they want to put them somewhere else and all mm-hmm. that. So it's sort of a microcosm of all that happened in Native America across the country.
Well, I could see why you like to write about history.
Right.
Now, what is it about writing horror that appeals to you? I always ask this question.
Well, I've always loved horror. I've always loved to be scared uh-huh. in the movies and all of that, reading books and so on. And I think it's a real challenge to scare people. And I don't like cheap scares. I don't like the cat jumping out of the cupboard when you open it up, or the hand falling out of the closet, some clown playing a trick on their buddy in these teen slasher flicks. I like real horror. I like subtle horror that builds up and up until you kind of feel like something's crawling up your back. Mm. So that's what I try to accomplish, a slow buildup to where I finally hit him in the face with it. In fact, one of the funniest stories about that, I think my most subtle and one of my favorites is a novel I wrote years ago that Bantam Books published called Demon Shadows. And it was subtle. It was and it is republished now. I republished it under my own imprint. And in the last chapter is where everything is supposed to hit the fan. And I built up subtle, 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 subtle. And the last chapter kind of stayed subtle. So Bantam, when they had the whole book, wrote back and said, "You need to jack up the horror in the last chapter. Have a ball."
Okay.
So I had a ball. I had a ball. It's really gross. I just reread it. Just let loose. It. So I built it up, and hopefully that would scare people. But it did take a buildup for that.
Well, it sounds like a fun read. Let's talk for a minute about your history of teaching. I mean, I know you've served as instructor for workshop facilitator for UCSD Extension, the Southern California Writers Conference, La Jolla Writers Conference, and the Alaska Writers Guild Conference. In 2002, you were honored as the first person of letters by the La Jolla Writers Conference for your quote-unquote ongoing and unselfish contributions to and support of the writing community. Can you tell us something about the San Diego writing community? Why do you enjoy working with the writing community? And
well, I enjoy working with writers, period, wherever they come from. You know, when I've met them from people from Australia, I've worked with people in Australia. I've worked with people in the Middle East and all. I just, writers love being around writers. There's a certain energy we have.
Yes.
That, and we understand each other, I think, mm-hmm. more than anyone else. You know, one writer is not going to ask a writer, "So you write books. Well, what do you do to make money? Or what's your day job?" There's just that, you know, that nobody asks you that, whereas in the real world, it's, "Oh, so you write books, but what do you do for a living?"
Right. What else do you do?
Yeah, exactly. And in most cases, that's true, unfortunately. It's not a road to riches, but we writers understand each other, and I've always loved to be around writers. I can pick out one incident. About six years ago, it was a week before the Southern California Writers Conference up in Newport Beach. And my 18-year-old cat passed away on my lap, and I was devastated. My wife was out of the country. I was all alone, and I had to deal with that. And I said, "I don't think I even want to go to the conference this year. You know, I was scheduled to do some mm-hmm. workshops and classes and one-on-ones, and I just didn't want to do it. I was so devastated by losing, you know, a beloved pet." And I made myself go up there, and I had such a great time, you know, just being around the energy of writers and everything. I just kind of forgot about it for a couple right. of days and just enjoyed myself. And that really said something. You know, that really said something,
yes, it does.
What writers are all about.
It does. I know that you've mentored a couple of successful authors here in town. Can you tell us about the mentoring process and how it feels to see those authors doing well?
One of the biggest thrills I have is, first of all, opening up a newly published book and in the acknowledgement seeing somebody thank me.
Yes.
That's happened many times. I've probably had, I know of about 100 novels that writers of mine that I've worked with in the past or more have been published. But I love going to their book signings, and I love, seeing the energy around them that they're so excited about it. It was interesting because when I stopped writing for quite a while to do this mentoring and teaching, and I wondered, how would I feel if one of my people is having this great success and I'm not being published anymore? And when the first one called up and said, I'm published, I actually bounced off the walls just as hard as she did.
Right.
I was so excited for her, and it was easy after that. Yeah. So I love seeing other people's successes and working with ones like I just finished about 20 novels with Michelle Scott, mm-hmm. who is a local author, and she was unpublished, unagented when I started working with her back in 2004, 10 years ago. And she's published about 20-odd novels since then. She's doing great. She's one of Amazon's top sellers. She can't put them out fast enough for them. And we're almost like family now. So I'm not working with too many people as much as I used to. But her I'll work with forever and some of my primary people. It is a matter of pride. It really is great to see people succeed and know you had some kind of mm-hmm. role in it.
I hear this a lot from writers about giving back.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we do. That's what we try to do in everything. And, I wasn't like that in the early days. To me, it was, I'm a writer. You're not.
Right.
I'm published. You're not. And I lost that attitude real quick. It's a very humbling profession. And now I just take joy in seeing others succeed and all of that. And I have fun doing what I do. But, that's it. I just enjoy writing and everything about it.
That's great to hear. Well, Mike, our time is up, but thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
For more information on Mike Sirota, his work, and his blog, which is called Swords, Specters, and Stuff, please visit his websites. He's got two of them at www.mikesirota.com and www.swordsandspectors.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Ed Barreno with the Sports Report. The Chargers won their playoff game Sunday in convincing fashion by shutting out the Cincinnati Bengals in the second half with the final score of 27-10. The Chargers were aggressive on defense and forced four turnovers without turning it over themselves. They now move on to the divisional round to face the AFC's number one seed, the Denver Broncos. The game will be in Denver, where San Diego won during the regular season. Also moving on in the AFC were the Indianapolis Colts, who will face the New England Patriots at Foxborough. And in the NFC, the Saints move on to face the Seahawks, and the 49ers move on to face the Panthers. The Chargers and Broncos kick off Sunday, January 12th at 1:40 Pacific Standard Time.
This is Janice Mork with People Power. The Boys and Girls Clubs of East County Foundation is halfway toward its goal to raise $8.9 million to construct a new clubhouse in La Mesa, renovate an existing teen center, and fund an endowment to operate both facilities. Donations include a $3 million pledge from La Mesa residents Mary Alice and Ron Brady, founders of the Brady Companies, a San Diego-based construction firm. With construction planned to begin in 2015, a new 25,000-square-foot clubhouse to be located on the La Mesa Middle School campus will be called the Brady Family Clubhouse, said Jerry Fazio, executive director of the foundation. The new clubhouse will feature the academy, a learning center, a full-service kitchen, and nutrition center, a separate Little Rascals area for 5 to 7-year-olds, and a gymnasium named for La Mesa native Bill Walton, a Helix High alumni and NBA Hall of Famer. The Brady donation will help renovate an existing teen center in La Mesa to be renamed the Brady Family Teen Center.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
If you need help with your taxes, the AARP Tax Aid Program can help. They're offering free tax preparation and e-filing for senior citizens, low-income residents, and others in need in the East County area. Tax sites will be open the week of February 3rd and continue until April 15th. The AARP Tax Aid Program will be available at the following locations: the El Cajon Library, College Avenue Senior Center, Alpine Senior Center, La Mesa Adult Enrichment Center, and Edgemoor Hospital. Two locations that have offered this service in the past, Lemon Grove Senior Center and the Salvation Army, will not be open this year. Past clients at these two sites are welcome to make an appointment at any of the other locations. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show: Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.